Hi there, welcome to House to Astonish, episode 61. I'm Al Kennedy.
And I'm Paul O'Brien. And in the week when lethal cucumbers have plagued Northern Europe, we ask, is this just a viral marketing campaign for the new Swamp Thing series?
But first, huge news from the last week. Obviously, we're lucky that we actually got this podcast in this week rather than next week. Previously, we've had things like Marvel getting bought by Disney and Paul being on holiday for 3 weeks and things like that. But we're in on the ground floor with this one. So, story everyone's talking about, Valiant is coming back.
Yay!
Yeah, it's the 1990s all over again. Soon we're going to be seeing the return of characters like Exo, Manowar and Bloodshot and Harbinger and Ninjak and all these kind of guys.
It truly is the future. But, no, okay, but we'll come back to Valiant. We'll come back to Valiant.
We are again. Would be as well just covering Valiant very quickly, because there's not a lot to it.
The CEO
of Valiant, a guy called Jason
Isn't
Cathari,
the Valiant still had a CEO?
Well, they do now. That he had to struggle quite hard to get back or to get hold of the rights to the Valiant characters and stories in the Valiant library.
Really?
That was finally sorted out in 2007. They have since then had further legal snags, but they managed to get out some hardback collections of things like Harbinger and Exo Manowar and so on, which I think was last year or possibly the year before. Brett Ratner apparently is looking to make a Harbinger movie, so I'm sure we all look forward to that one. It's a kind of a hurrah ba moment for anybody who is a fan of Harbinger. It's like, hurrah, there's going to be a Harbinger movie. Bah, it's going to be a Brett Ratner movie. Although, you know, the most they can hope for is that it languishes in development hell forever and never gets made. But he's now got funding from Peter Cuneo, the ex-Marvel vice president.
Oh, right, okay. Who actually wants to get involved in comics again, but this time lose money.
Yes, well, he left Marvel at the time of the Disney buyout.
Right.
And he's got an investment company, which is called something like Cuneo Associates LLC or something like that. And it's investing in Valiant with the intention that Valiant will launch a few comics, both print and digitally, next year at some point. They're still working on getting movies done. They're still working on getting more collections out of the old Valiant stuff. They're aware of the fact they don't have the gold key characters anymore, but according to them, that's not important to their future.
They're just going to leave those out entirely. Well, look, Valiant, it's not a good omen that they've chosen to announce this in the week of the biggest comics news of the year.
Yeah.
Where they've been completely overshadowed. But
it's unfortunate.
And I'm honestly surprised that somebody is that willing to pour money into trying to make a company like Valiant fly in the current climate. And in the market at its height, yeah, in 2011, 2012?
One of the things that was being said in the interview that I read on CBR with Jason Cathari was that you know, this is obviously a very low point for a lot of people. People are quite depressed about the fact that the economy is very bad.
If only Exo Manowar was back in print.
He'll save us. Exo Manowar versus the recession. People apparently, according to him, are like, well, we'll turn to things that give us comfort, like comic books from our youth. Which makes me think, you know, does he think we're in the Second World War? People don't, you know, back then, yes, people turned to comic books for a bit of solace. Nowadays, I don't think people turn to comic books for solace. I think people get rid of comic books because they can't afford them.
Maybe he's obviously imagining an audience of people who bought the Valiant comics in the mid-90s who are going to come back and go, yes, I'm comforted by this as my house is repossessed.
Exactly, I can build a small lean-to of issues of Archer and Armstrong.
This is an optimistic business plan.
I think so, definitely.
Anyway, we've spent 3 minutes talking about this, which is disproportionate
to its importance.
Let's move on.
Yes, talking about
DC.
Optimistic business plans. DC, in September, are doing everything.
Yeah, they are relaunching the entire DC Universe line. They do say DC Universe, so presumably Vertigo and whatever other imprint, they have the Looney Tunes stuff, I guess.
Yeah, the carry on kids as before. Stuff, the Johnny DC stuff, presumably will just go on as it was.
But that aside, it's a complete relaunch for the DC Universe. I'm not clear whether this is going to be a hard reboot or a soft reboot, whether they're just going to tweak continuity like they did in Zero Hour.
Mm.
I kind of suspect it's going to be a soft reboot.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were talking about it in terms of it being a reboot to begin with. J. Michael Straczynski was saying on his Facebook page that it was going to be a reboot because it was all Dan DiDio's idea, and he wanted it to be like what happened in the 70s with several of DC's characters. Whether it is just Dan DiDio's idea or not, I don't know. J. Michael Straczynski's not always the most 100% reliable guy when it comes to telling the full story of things on the internet.
And also, by all accounts, things have moved on a bit since those initial discussions with him, so things, plans may have changed, even if Straczynski's remembering it all correctly.
Yes. Bob Wayne wrote a letter to retailers in which he stressed that this was not a line-wide reboot. Well, his exact words were, it would be a more modern, diverse DCU with some character variations in appearance, origin and age. Some of the characters will have new origins, while others will undergo minor changes.
So they're not just rebooting everything. I think, to be fair, nobody wants to come out in September and discover that every single comic is embarking on a 6-issue origin story.
Mm-hmm.
That would just be awful.
Yes. And you know that they would just do variations on the old origins anyway. It would be, all right, we've got 6 issues of the Flash's origin. Let's start with him getting covered in chemicals and struck by lightning.
Most books are getting new creative teams or being replaced altogether, but there are those titles which are going perfectly happily at the moment, where you think, why on earth would you want to replace this creative team or even derail the story? I mean, the one that leaps out is the current direction of the Batman titles, where Grant Morrison's some way into a multi-year storyline. Why on earth would you want to risk messing that up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently it was supposed to have been a 24-issue storyline, Batman Incorporated.
Yep.
But, you know, it's going to end up being 7 or 8 issues long if it's going to be relaunched or if it's going to be changed in any way. If this story is not going to be continuing on, his whole Leviathan Batman Incorporated story, then what actually is going to happen with that? Is he going to try to wrap it up in 2 months? Or, you know, are we just going to see it unsatisfactorily ended?
I would have thought there's going to be a very awkward shoehorning of books like Batman into this supposed relaunch structure, where they're just going to have to do something which is a jumping on point, but basically carry on with what they were already doing.
Yes,
I can't see how else they can do that.
Things like Green Lantern, for instance, definitely is going down that route. We can come on to that when we talk about the teams that are going to be on some of these books. But yeah, sorry, you were saying.
Something else that's been pointed out is this may be, to some extent, a device for them to extricate Superman from some of the plot elements that they don't own. Now, I don't buy into the conspiracy theory that says this entire thing is a device for them to diminish using Superman elements. But given that they're revamping continuity anyway, I wouldn't be at all surprised if they took the opportunity to minimise the number of elements they're using in the character that they don't own.
It seems strange that you would take a character like Superman, who is so iconic. You know, he is the most iconic comic book character probably that has ever been created.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just talking about superhero comics. There probably has never been a more immediately recognisable character in the whole of comics.
It's him, unless or Batman, or possibly the Hulk.
I think you could go to some tiny town in North Korea and show them the S symbol and they would know that was Superman. I don't think you could go look at who this is. Bruce Banner as drawn by Ron Garney from John Byrne's Hulk run.
Yeah, true.
Who is this? And they've just gone, But, you know, Superman is probably the most famous character that originated in comics anyway. I mean, obviously there have been Mickey Mouse comics and things like that, and Mickey Mouse is probably one of the most famous characters in the entire world. But why would you take the opportunity to relaunch your whole line, streamline the whole thing, make it as accessible to new readers? Because that is the unspoken subtext. This whole thing is, we need to shake up our universe, because otherwise it will just become more and more vestigial until it drops off the end of Warner Brothers like some kind of tail on a evolving human. You know,
is that the message? Because they haven't really announced any new books so far that are massively different from what they would be doing already.
We don't know what they're doing in it. We know the names and creative teams of some. We don't really know much of the detail of any of the
books. That's true, but they've yet to announce any books where you would think, ooh, I can't imagine DC publishing that now. I haven't seen a single... they've announced some books where you think, that's interesting, I'd buy that. I'd be vaguely interested if they just announced that on its own. But I don't think they've announced anything that has made me think, these are a completely different type of book from what we're doing before. Yeah. They have talked about there being a broader range. There have been vague mentions of war comics,
Westerns,
comics and other genres. We'll see about that. I mean, to be fair, they've already got Jonah Hex, and I strongly suspect that if they're being asked, you know, what are you doing other than superhero comics? Well, unless they're cancelling Jonah Hex, we've got a Western. And there'll be something with a gun. You know?
Yeah, I think...
It could be as little as that, or it could genuinely be that they're going to diversify more, and we'll find out more as the other titles have announced.
I think it's not a case, though, that... I'm not suggesting that they're going to be doing necessarily a lot of different type of book. What I'm suggesting is that the subtext is they're trying to attract a new readership, and I think they definitely are trying to do that with this, you know, number ones across the board. It's a new universe. You shouldn't have to look back to the old one, although we'll see how long that lasts.
I don't see how you can make it a completely fresh start if you've got storylines in progress in Batman and Green Lantern.
Just stop doing them.
Green Lantern
is heading towards a wrap-up anyway.
Well, that's different. Green Lantern's at least going to finish a story and go forward from there, but Batman's in mid-storyline.
Yeah, I can't help but thinking that some of these creators are either going to get kind of shafted by this, or they're going to end up getting essentially hall passes to just keep going. You know, it'll be issue one of Batman Incorporated, in which Batman will make brief reference in a couple of pages to his new status quo, and then it'll be back to doing the Leviathan storyline.
Well, I think they've already had to announce that one of these new anthology titles is going to have in its first issue part 7 of a storyline that originally began in
Weird Worlds. It's Kevin Maguire's Tanga and Aaron LaPriestie's Garbage Man are both going to be continuing into is it My Greatest Adventure it's going to be called?
That's a serious error.
It's unbelievably dumb. Like, I mean,
calling the comic My Greatest Adventure is also a bad idea. That's a title with nothing to commend it other than the fact that it was used in the 1960s.
Yeah.
It makes the thing sound... I mean, I don't know, in fairness, if they're going to publish in that book stories where the entire vibe is meant to be 60s throwback... Maybe. If it's meant to be sort of B-movie exploitation type thing.
Which Garbage Man is a bit like that, but Tanga's not like that.
No,
Tanga's about a character that pulls a lot of faces and talks incessantly.
Yeah.
But then again, that's a Kevin Maguire book for you. I see where you're coming from with the whole My Greatest Adventure thing. It does actually sound like one of those books that you used to see advertised in Sunday papers, where you could send off a photograph of your kid and like details of their name and their school and two of their pals, and you would get back a book which was all about them that had their photo in it. My greatest adventure, starring Alistair, age 4.
I mean, I think the basic idea of doing a jumping on point for the whole DC universe, or of doing a reboot and saying you don't need to have read anything that's come before, we are starting from scratch here. If anything that's happened before is important, we'll set it up in these stories as if it was a new plot element. Mm. I mean, you can have it both ways. You can just say, this is a starting point. And yes, maybe even continuity hasn't changed, but if it matters, we'll explain it to you as if it was a new point.
Yep.
But...
I just realised I never finished my thinking on Superman being iconic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I tangented myself, it's fine. He is this incredibly iconic character. And what they're looking at doing, but just by the looks of the art, I mean, I can't speak to the book yet, because obviously we haven't seen the book, but by the looks of the art, they're making Superman younger, they're changing his costume to something which vaguely resembles the Superman costume, but not really. And they're kind of making him different from the ur-Superman, if you like, sort of the platonic ideal of Superman. I mean, what they've done in the last few years is they've gotten away from the Superman that... your man in the street would know. You ask somebody who doesn't read comics, who's Superman? Superman is Clark Kent. He's a journalist. His girlfriend is Lois Lane. Or at least he's in some kind of romantic back and forth love triangle style thing with Lois Lane and Superman. They may know about Jimmy Olsen. They may, if you're lucky, know about Perry White. What they will not tell you is, yes, Superman walks across America, doesn't use his powers to fly, tells a guy that he's going to have a heart attack and doesn't do anything about it, tells a little kid to go and tell some drug dealers to leave the street and doesn't actually do anything about it, is an absolute jerk to the Flash. Yet this is not the Superman that, you know, Superman flies. He uses heat vision. He punches things really hard. How difficult is that?
Do you know this is the third major comic book hero that J. Michael Straczynski has worked on, where as soon as he's left, they've had to hit the cosmic reset button. Now, yeah. In fairness to him, it's also the third consecutive one he's worked on where he probably knew that as soon as he left, they were going to hit the cosmic reset button, which might explain why he's doing stories that would otherwise have been permanently damaging to the character.
Yeah,
I remember him saying actually that he was under the impression that nonsense about Norman Osborn and Gwen Stacy having kids was going to be erased with the cosmic reset at the end of his run.
Right, okay. Does make you wonder why he did the terrible story in the first place.
Because he figured it wouldn't do any long-term damage because it was going to be undone at the end.
Yeah, still on a month-to-month basis though, if you're paying $2.99 an issue for what was a six-issue terrible story.
It was awful.
There's no point in putting that story out. Anyway,
it
does seem strange that they would reboot the line and not decide to go for, if you're trying to attract new readers, not go for a version of the character that new readers will go, oh yeah, I know about Superman. That's what Superman looks like.
I think, to be fair, this may well feed into this issue of, are they trying to protect themselves against the elements of the character which they've lost in court?
Yeah, and Jim Lee has redesigned, apparently, 50-plus costumes from the DCU.
A lot of V-necks.
He seems to have redesigned them on a template, doesn't he? In the 1990s, there was a vest for every Avenger period, and now we've got the V-neck for every JLA member period.
We've talked about the general idea that they're going to relaunch the line. The specifics. At the end of August, I think they're going to ship one comic in the last week of August.
Two, Flashpoint and Justice League.
Flashpoint and Justice League. So they're going to ship two comics, and then they tell us that starting in September, relaunch of the entire line, everything goes back to issue one or is a new launch.
Mm-hmm.
52 ongoing series.
Yes.
Now, that's a massive number. Even Marvel at the moment only has something like 36 ongoing series in the Marvel Universe, plus minis, admittedly. Mm. I would hope that there are no miniseries coming out alongside this. To be fair, while they have told us relaunching starting in September, 52 issues, they haven't actually said they're all coming out in September.
Oh, okay. Well,
if you read very closely, they don't actually say that. They say the relaunch will be in September. They don't say all 52 are coming out in the first month.
Fair enough.
I have to say that the idea of releasing 52 new issue ones in the same month is suicide. And I think that is a major error if that is what they are planning to do. I just don't see how that many new titles, and there will be many new titles if they're going to get it up to 52, can possibly all find an audience simultaneously. A lot of books that would have done okay if promoted individually among an established line will just be completely lost in the shuffle if they're sent out in that way. That said, I don't know how long you can realistically drag it out for to relaunch. I mean, the fact that it's 52 makes me wonder whether at some point somebody was seriously suggesting, why don't we launch a book a week for a year? And that would have been awesome, except for one obvious point, which is that there would be virtually no product on the shelves for the first few months, and all the retailers would go bankrupt. So they clearly can't be intending that. But I do think that they've got to spread this out over at least 3 months if they're going to launch that many titles. Anything else is suicide.
Well, I'm just thinking, if they've got, at the moment, in May, they had, counting miniseries, admittedly, but in May, they had 48 DCU issues.
Sure. How many of those sold in numbers which would be acceptable for an issue one?
Who knows, but, I mean, are they going to, statistically, is issue 76 of Teen Titans going to sell more or fewer than issue one of Teen Titans? Is issue 19 of Green Arrow going to sell more or fewer than issue 1 of Green Arrow? Is the first issue of any given book in a given month going to sell more? What I think we're going to see is September will be, I think, the first time that DC beat Marvel in terms of dollar share in a long time.
I think that
in
may be,
a long time.
I think that may be right up to a point, assuming they do put out a whole load of books
if
in September.
If they launch all 52 in September. In fact, if they launch all 52 in September, they'll probably beat them in unit share.
Yeah, I think that's right, but there's two points to bear in mind here. First of all, recent history shows that renumbering stunts don't work beyond the first month. You get a surge of sales on the first month, and then sales go right back to where they were before. Mm. It achieves nothing beyond boosting your sales for 1 month. Secondly, that works even on that level when you've got one title standing out among the crowd. I don't think that the audience has enough money to buy all 52 of these titles. I don't think the resources in the market are there for the sales to surge on all of DC's line simultaneously. The money just is not there to pay for that.
I think what will happen is nobody will buy all... Well, that's a complete nonsense. Some people will buy all 52.
Some people will, but I mean, realistically, the number of people...
What you're not going to get is the same amount of people buying issue one of Mr. Terrific as are going to be buying issue one of Superman. That is, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But DC are not expecting that. They'd be crazy to expect that. What they're expecting is that Mr. Terrific will sell enough to keep it going, because enough people will be interested in the issue one. They don't have to make, you know, 100,000 sales on all of these titles. They just have to make more than what they're making at the moment. And in case of some of these books, that's zero.
That is true. I just don't see that the audience has the financial resources to push 52 books to that level of success. Mm. I think they're being... that's 52 ongoings as well, bear in mind. Unless DC is going to completely abandon doing miniseries.
Mm. Yeah, well, that would be interesting, because if they're doing ongoings, then what is going to also have to change is the speed and the regularity at which they bring out collections.
Well, this brings us to the other side of things, which is that also in September, DC are going day and date with digital release.
Yeah, I think this is probably as big a deal as the whole relaunching the entire line thing.
And in some ways, justifies the renumbering, because it means that, assuming they set up their app properly, mm-hmm. you should be in a situation where readers can go to the app and are told unequivocally, this is the starting point for this book. It starts with issue 1. It doesn't start with issue 629 or whatever. It starts with issue 1.
And take note, it doesn't start with issue 0.1 either.
Yeah, yeah. I think in terms of how it would be presented on the digital app, I think there is actually something to be said for the idea of a line-wide renumbering.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly given that they're also partnering with iTunes to sell their comics.
That's interesting.
Which is interesting. First comic company to do that.
Now, they are going to sell them at the same price as in stores for the first 4 weeks and then drop the price by $1 to $1.99. That has been a somewhat controversial decision. I think that the problem for DC here is, and it's a point I've made in this podcast several times before, you've got to strike a balance. Yes, digital comics are probably the future. It's difficult to see how the future is the direct market, mm-hmm. unless you're happy with comic sales remaining at their present level. But you can't just cut the legs out from under the direct market until something else is up and running and well established.
Yes.
And making that migration is a difficult business, and it's going to be at least a medium-term job. Trying to undercutting the direct market now and essentially encouraging everyone to go digital is like sawing off a branch that you're still sitting on.
Yeah, they have to bring the retailers with them in this. They cannot have the situation whereby they say, right, retailers, we're going day and date digital, all our books are going to be $1.99, which, yes, we know is cheaper than it is in your shop, but we don't have any overheads.
One particularly odd angle to this is that they are also going to apparently sell in stores a polybagged version for an extra dollar, where you get a digital copy as well.
Yeah, that's just with Justice League, but yeah.
Why?
Because you don't always want to carry your comics around with you. I mean,
I think that's a serious error. I think they should just be giving them away for the digital
Justice
copies
League.
Away for the same price.
Yeah, I honestly think that if you went to the shop and bought a copy of Justice League issue 1, you're absolutely right. You should have the code for the digital download, because Justice League is going to be, for August anyway, I think probably DC's biggest seller. I think it'll sell more than Flashpoint 5, and I think both of those books will sell more than any other DC comic published in August. So for that 1 month, Justice League is likely to be the biggest selling DC comic. Is there any better way to get people on board with your new day and date digital distribution than to give them the first hit free?
Yeah. I think the other angle to this is, I'm not sure they necessarily want fans to be buying the fresh issues straight off digital. But what they do want is a situation where if you want to jump on board a series, it's all there immediately on digital.
Yeah, honestly, I think long term they probably do want people to be buying because...
Well, in the long term, yes. Overheads. In the long term, yes. But there have been... One of the issues that comics have at the moment, and one of the reasons why sales keep going down and down and down, is that it's almost impossible to jump onto a series once it's underway. And one reason for that is the long delay in putting the comics up on online, unless, of course, you're willing to torrent them illegally. And the high prices and the refusal to make them available sensibly is one of the major incentives for people to do that.
Yeah.
What you want, if you're DC, is a situation where if a comic's getting good word of mouth... then you don't get people going, oh, that sounds like a good book. Oh, it's four issues in. I can't start buying it now. I'll wait for the trade paperback. Trade paperback comes out 7 months later, by which time everyone's forgotten. That's why one of the problems they have at the moment.
Mm.
Under the new system, if a comic's getting good word of mouth four issues in, people can go in and buy the previous three and then jump on board in a way that they cannot do at the moment.
Yes, absolutely.
That is potentially a big deal. Now... I mean, I think this whole thing sounds to me like basically quite a good idea. If you view this as being a transitional arrangement at a period when they're trying to build up digital so that in due course they can move there, I think they're right not to try to run before they can walk.
Yes.
But digital, so simply putting everything on digital at 99 cents, they would not support themselves that way in the near future. And they would kill a lot of the comic stores, and that would be catastrophic for their business.
Mm-hmm.
I think so the general structure of what DC is trying to do here, I think, makes a lot of sense. I think the volume of material they're trying to launch in September is worrying and suggests they have bitten off more than they can chew. They've fallen in love with this number 52.
Yeah.
Are there 52 good creative teams?
No, well, there definitely aren't, because out of the ones that have been announced so far, two of them are written by J.T. Krull. So clearly not, no. What I think as well we're going to see over the next year is going to be massive, wild fluctuation of sales in DC's comics as retailers try to work out what on earth the sensible levels are to order these books at.
Because since they're not going to be able to order all of these comics in issue one numbers if they all come out simultaneously, what happens the second month? Because conventional wisdom is what you do the second month is you slash orders 20%.
Yep.
If orders don't go up hugely for issue one, do retailers then figure, well, they'll probably stay the same as normal for issue two? Or...
Particularly when you're getting a whole load of new titles. Like, for instance, Rich Johnson's reported on Bleeding Cool that there's likely to be a new Grifter series. Possibly one of several new Wildstorm launches.
Now, that's insane if they're going to do that in September.
Do they think that a rising tide is going to lift all boats and that there is actually going to be an interest in Grifter or Gen 13 or Authority or Wildcats or whatever other Wildstorm thing they want to launch? Or are retailers just going to look at it and go, it's Wildstorm, it's dead.
Yes.
Let's not order it.
No, I mean, exactly. Wildstorm is not even a twitching corpse. It's just...
This is the point where lesser podcasts would go into a Monty Python routine.
The thing with Wildstorm is, if you do it as part of this relaunch, as you say, nobody is going to buy all 52 comics. Mm. Even the most avid DC fan is likely to say, either I don't have the money for all 52 comics... Or, I do have the money, but because I have the sort of job that gives me the money, I don't have the time to read all 52 comics.
I bet you that the most avid DC fan will buy all 52 and they'll eat ramen.
There'll be a few, but the majority are going to say, well, I can't buy all of them. Which ones am I not going to buy? Who, the Wildstorm books, they'll be dead in 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why you don't launch them. It's going against the background of everything else.
Yeah, it's going to be the sales are going to be bonkers for about a year, I would say probably. I bet you, please, you do the Marvel write ups at the beep. Sorry, Mark Oliver, you're going to have your work cut out for you.
Well, I mean, he's got the advantage; he'll have a lot less maths to do with so many new titles coming along.
Indeed. Some of the actual books that have been announced, we've got quite a few of them.
Grant Morrison on Superman, that's obviously going to be good.
In some kind of shape or form, Grant Morrison's going to be writing Superman.
Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang on Wonder Woman.
Yes!
Interesting choice.
Yes.
Azzarello doesn't strike me as a Wonder Woman writer.
No, but then again, he didn't strike me particularly as a Doctor 13 writer either. But Doctor 13, Architecture and Morality, which was the backup strip in... Oh, what was it called? Countdown to Mystery, I think it was called. He did that with Cliff Chang, and it was brilliant. The two of them worked so well together on that that I will be buying this Wonder Woman series absolutely sight unseen.
I'll try it.
Definitely on board for that.
I've never been a big fan of Brian Azzarello, but in a sense,
have you read 100 Bullets?
I think I got about halfway through the preview of the first issue and thought, not for me.
Oh, okay. I'll get the first three or four trades if you want to borrow them. It's pretty great.
Geoff Johns and Jim Lee on Justice League.
See how many issues that we get out of Jim Lee.
Well, that's a point people have been making.
Wildcats issues did we get?
To be fair, Jim Lee did used to be able to hold a monthly schedule in his peak. There weren't that many fill-ins on his X-Men run.
I guess he did a year of Batman and a year of Superman, which came out... relatively on time.
And how long has he been working on this? I mean, to be fair, all they needed to deliver is six issues by him. First trade. They've delivered what they promised.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can hand it over to another if the schedule's not looking too good.
Yeah, what's the betting that issue three's by Pete Woods?
Aquaman, Geoff Johns and Ivan Reis. That's something that was already set up at the end of Brightest Day, wasn't
it? Well, it's weird. Because you look at the Brightest Day, end of Brightest Day Aquaman, and he gets his hand off and everything like that. It's just all a bit extreme and a bit gory and bits of people being ripped off because it's...
Not again.
It's a Geoff Johns comic. Have you read the issue? It hilariously, you've got the baddie having cut his hand off. He says to him, "What's wrong, Aquaman? Thought you'd be used to that by now." It's just like, snap.
when the characters are mocking the plot...
But yeah, so Johns and Rice, were long-term Green Lantern team. They're doing this new Aquaman. Aquaman appears to have both hands in the previews. What was the point of doing that story at that point? Hawkman is coming back. Hawkman with a new origin and everything. Hawkman was also part of the whole Brightest Day thing. What was the point of doing that? How long have they been planning this thing for? Given that Batwoman was solicited for, last month and then was... knocked back into the autumn, presumably to launch as part of one of these 52 series.
Well, supposedly
were they thinking about this like 9 months ago, 6 months ago.
Well, supposedly this whole relaunch is an idea that was originally pitched to happen after Final Crisis, and was knocked back at the time.
I just don't understand then why they've been setting up new long-term status quos for characters that were just about to be swept out from underneath them. I honestly think it's just a case of not thinking far enough ahead. But
Geoff Johns and Doug Mank on Green Lantern.
Yeah, Johns and Mank, they did bits of Infinite Crisis together, didn't they? Did he not step in for... Oh, no, wait a second, was it Final Crisis? Mankey stepped in for J.G. Jones on whichever one it was that Jones was mm-hmm. drawing. I think it was actually Final Crisis.
But these are solid creative teams. I can't say I'm suddenly excited to read an Aquaman of a Green Lantern comic, but they're putting their reasonably big guns on.
Yeah, I'll buy the first issue of Aquaman to see what it's like. I have to say, I've got no nostalgia for Aquaman. I've got no great love for the character, but I'll be interested to see what the direction of this series is, and if it is interesting, I might go back and buy some more. But it doesn't leap out at me.
Firestorm, written by Gail Simone and Ethan Van Sciver, art by Yildiray Senar.
Yildiray Senar.
I can't read your writing.
Yildiray Senar sounds like a Green Lantern.
It does, doesn't it?
I wonder if he is a Green Lantern.
Gail Simone's talking that one up quite a lot.
Gail Simone and Ethan Van Sciver have been trying to get a book to work on together for the longest time. They were going to be doing, I think, like Plastic Man or something like that together.
And now that there are 52 slots to fill,
yeah,
it's time to phone Gail Simone and Evan Van Sciver. That should be a good comic.
Yeah. I mean,
When did Gail Simone last do a comic that wasn't good?
There must be one.
Hawkman, anyway. Tony
we'll
Daniel
we'll
and
come
Philip.
Back to that if we can think of one.
Hawkman, Tony Daniel and Philip Tam.
Now, we're getting able to divide these books now into the interesting and we'll check them out. And
that also has been published.
That's also one of 52 books. Tony Daniel and Philip Tan's Hawkman series. That's... Oh, I'm sorry, that's three no's. I'm sorry, yes. You're not going through to the next round.
Francis Manapul and Brian Buccellato on Flash. Co-writing and co-arting.
Yes, Francis Manapul is co-writing and
co-drawing,
it.
Yeah.
And Brian Buccellato is writing, I presume also colouring, given that he is one of the amazing flying Buccellato brothers, colourists.
The Flash run that Manapul recently drew for Geoff Johns wasn't that well received. But I really like his art.
I like his art. I'm not sure
he's
sold on him as a Flash artist.
I know what you mean.
I think he needs a busier artist than that. He does these brilliantly kind of sedate looking bucolic scenes. You know, you expect him to be painting landscapes or something like that. I don't think he's got the frantic energy that a Flash artist needs.
Mm.
But, you know, he obviously seems very happy working on the Flash.
J.T. Krull and Dan Juergens on Green Arrow. No. That's Dan Juergens
and the one in column B.
Dan Juergens and Aaron Lopresti on Justice League International. I was quite looking forward to JLI coming out of the Generation Lost thing. But now I see that it's by Dan Juergens and Aaron Lopresti, I'm significantly less interested.
I don't know. Dan Juergens is one of these weird guys who is, on the whole, usually quite a solid but non-flashy writer, who over the last couple of years has done a couple of things that were just wildly wrong and just terrible. His Booster Gold has been very variable.
Mm.
Although he did also get a year off Booster Gold while DeMatteis and Giffen were writing.
Yeah, I dropped it when he came back on.
I have to say that I am reading it since he came back on. I bought the Flashpoint tie-in issue, but I won't be buying any more of them because it's not very good.
Eric Wallace and Roger Robinson on Mr. Terrific.
Yep, Eric Wallace, who did Teen Titans, and Roger Robinson, who did 2468 Motorway. J.T. Krull and Freddie Williams II on Captain Atom. Again, it's a J.T. Krull book.
It doesn't sound hugely promising. Mm-hmm. Paul Jenkins and Bernard Chang on DC Universe Presents, starting with a Dead Man arc.
Yeah, they're...
DC Universe Presents?
DC Universe Presents is going to be... What they want it to be is sort of big-name writers and artists working on a kind of rotating set of characters. So you've got Dead Man first. Paul Jenkins, yeah, I guess, fair enough. He's a kind of probably B-list writer.
I wonder if these anthology titles like DC Universe Presents and My Greatest Adventure are what we're getting instead of miniseries under the new 52-book format.
DC Universe Presents, I don't think, is actually an anthology. I think it's going to be like DC Legends used to be, where you'll have one or two or three issue arcs by a particular creative team.
So it's replacing mini. That's my point. It's effectively a series of miniseries, and you can what used to be miniseries could now just appear under that, and that sticks you with your 52.
Yeah, what I think is good about this one that is not the case with My Greatest Adventure. Well, you know, one of many things about My Greatest Adventure that is not that great is that this is not a multi-story anthology, because as we've seen with so many multi-story anthologies in the American market in the past few years. Things like Marvel Comics Presents, things like Weird Worlds. People just... I mean, I don't know whether it's because writers of American superhero comics are not trained to write short stories.
I think...
Like, trained to write 8-page chapters or whatever. British creators who've worked on 2000 AD and so on have got the ability to do that. Much less so the guys who have not come up with that kind of discipline.
Yeah.
But the DC Universe Presents thing, it does seem to be... It's going to be full issues of these particular characters.
Peter Tomasi and Fernando Pessarin on Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah, and Tony Bedard and Tyler Kirkham on Green Lantern New Guardians, and Peter Milligan and Ed Bennis on Red Lanterns.
So there's an entire imprint there.
Hardly changing at all.
Yeah. Scott Lobdell and Brett Booth on Teen Titans.
You can't see me shaking my head whilst I cradle it in my hands here, listeners, but I am.
It's been a while since Scott Lobdell was writing a regular series.
It seems a while since the owl was terrorising New York City. It's not a good thing, necessarily, that he's back.
Hasn't he been off writing films or something like that?
Ugh, I don't know. Last series that I read that he did was the Alpha Flight relaunch that was the inverted commas comedy. And that was poo.
Question, when does Marvel follow suit with Day and Date Digital?
They seem to be quite far behind a lot of DC's business decisions in terms of things that they can and can't justify doing. Marvel has yet to make the step to doing original graphic novels, really, for instance.
That's not a major part of DC's business.
No, but it's something that DC does, and Marvel does not do. Vertigo in particular. Although DC now, obviously, with the success of things like Joker and Earth One, are going to be making more inroads to doing OGNs. Marvel's only graphic novel that I can remember them announcing for Last Age is that Castle tie-in that they're doing, the Nathan Fillion TV show tie-in, where they're doing an OGN of one of the stories from that.
To be honest, we're reaching the point where the Marvel Universe might actually benefit from a continuity reboot.
Well, I think
there's characters there who are dragging 50 years of accumulated continuity behind them.
Yeah, but you only need to refer to as much continuity as is actually necessary for the story. You don't need to talk about the fact that there was this Archon story in Avengers or whatever.
That's true. I mean, Marvel, I think, will have to go day and date at some point. They obviously are more sceptical about whether this is the right time to do it. And what's going to be interesting is to see... You know, they obviously will not want to be seen as tailing along after DC. But it's obviously something they'll want to do in due course. Neither Marvel nor DC is in the business of keeping retailers happy for the sake of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I think retailers understand that, though. I mean, I don't think there are retailers that feel Marvel and DC owe them a living. You know, retailers do know that time is going to move on and eventually more people are going to access their comic books digitally.
Yeah. If you're a smart retailer, realistically, you've got to be planning for what your business is going to do in the in a post-direct market age.
Yeah.
One answer to that is you become a specialist bookshop. Another answer to that is you diversify and also into all sorts of cult TV collectible materials, which is the direction Forbidden Planet's kind of gone in. And I don't say I blame them for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other side of it, though, I guess, is that direct market retailers can expect or should expect that DC and Marvel, just to name two publishers, are not going to cut their noses off to spite their face and just go, right, well, we don't care what happens to you, direct market, we're going to just go digital all the way, because the direct market is still a pretty big, in fact, the vast majority of the business that they do.
Marvel and DC need the direct market for now.
Yes, one day they won't. And that day is probably still quite some way off, but we're heading in that direction. Speaking of publishers linking in with direct market retailers, though, just very quickly, our last bit of news is that Dark Horse has announced digital retailer incentives, which are a kind of a variation, really, on what's happening with this Justice League download thing. What's going to happen is that at the start of a month, Dark Horse is going to email 100 codes, unique codes, to retailers. So sort of per retailer, 100 per retailer. And the retailer will then be able to give those codes out to their customers, you know, at their discretion. And each code will allow the download of an 8-page story, which is supplementary to a book that they're publishing. And it's their big books that they're publishing. There's a Buffy one, a BPRD one, a Mass Effect one, are the first three that are scheduled. And they're only going to be available this way. You know, if you don't go to your comic shop and give them one of these codes, you just won't get one of these 8-page stories of one of these comics that you like.
So they're not even going to be in the collected editions?
I don't know.
Certainly, they'll be collected at some point.
I presume at some point down the road, but if you want to read it at the time, then the incentive is to go into your comic book shop
and get
given a code by your retailer.
I understand why Dark Horse is trying to make it look as though the interests of retailers and digital comics converge. They don't, but they can be maybe made to converge artificially in the short term.
Yes, for a while, as a kind of a transition thing.
That's the news.
Right.
Let's talk reviews. What shall we start
comics.
With?
I don't mind.
Criminal, Last of the Innocent,
yes.
Number one, by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. This is the
absolutely.
First new Criminal miniseries in
over a year.
And
they've been doing Incognito.
Yeah. So it's 1982, and a guy called Riley is going back home to his relatively small town.
Because his dad is dying of stomach cancer.
Yeah.
And he's going in for an operation, and he wants to be there when his dad has the operation.
And at the same time, he owes money to some nasty people, because this is criminal.
In the big city.
So he kind of needs to come up with the money, although that kind of gets shoved to the background for most of the issue.
Yes, it's kind of a backdrop against which this is painted.
Yeah, even though this is an issue of criminal, basically this is a story about a guy going back to his small town and...
Largely a story about relationships, I think. It's a study of this one character and the friendships that he has versus the friendships that he had when he was a kid. It's basically a story along the lines of You Can't Go Home Again.
Yeah.
When he does go back to his small town, which is Brookview, he finds it hard to fit in with the people who are there because he has changed as a person. He's not the guy who grew up in this small town anymore. He and his unpleasant wife, who also grew up in this small town, moved to the big city. And there's a lot of stuff in this book about how they have changed as people and become harder and more selfish people. In things like, for instance, their wedding, they make everybody come to the city to go to their wedding. And there's a funeral in this issue at which they make one of their friends, who's a singer, come to the small town to sing at the funeral and cancel a concert to come to sing at the funeral. And it's really kind of all about the way that people who are friends as kids can grow up to be quite unpleasant or venal people.
There's a gimmick where the flashbacks to his childhood are all done in what's obviously is meant to be loosely the style of Archie.
It's partly the style of Archie, yes. What I also think, I mean, a lot of these characters kind of map onto Archie characters.
Yes.
So, for instance, Riley is Archie, his wife is Veronica, his druggy mate is Jughead, the guy who's having an affair with his wife, spoilers, is Reggie. You know, there are kind of one-to-ones that his mate, who was his female unrequited love, really, who, you know, there were two girls who he liked when he was at school, you know, she's Betty. There are the Archie characters, essentially. And that's kind of what Phillips is doing in his flashback art. What I also see in this art is, and this is the reason why... The reason why I got the Shazam showcase off the shelf earlier on. I see a lot of C.C. Beck's art.
Actually, you're right. There is a sort of similarity there. I don't know whether that's simply because they're deliberately going for C.C. Beck, or whether it's because when Sean Phillips tries to do Archie, it comes out like C.C. Beck.
It comes out a bit like that.
And I think it may be the latter. Because, I mean, Archie is obviously the touch point here. What actually happens in these flashbacks is not particularly Archie at all. But it's the style in which they're done.
Which I think is also part of the point of doing them in this style, is to show that, yeah, he's got these kind of rose-tinted memories of when he was a kid. He looks back at these things as if they were Archie comics.
Yeah.
But they weren't. They were always a gang of people who were kind of slightly squabbly, kind of not 100% always the nicest people.
Yeah.
And this has just become more pronounced as they've grown older. But it really is a case of looking back at the past through these kind of rose-tinted spectacles and saying, oh, it was like the comics, it was like Archie, it was like the Marvel Family stuff I used to read when I was a kid. And it's like, well, you can look at it through that lens if you want, but that's not supported by the events.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of nostalgia and use of comics as a type of childhood nostalgia. It's an interesting issue to appear in criminal because, frankly, there's not much crime in this. That's very much a background element. I'm no doubt it becomes more prominent in the later issues.
There's a criminal plot, as it were, set up at the end of this issue, but that's not key to this first issue. The first issue is all about setting up the relationships, the characters, putting the pieces out on the board, and establishing, I guess, the kind of overarching message of this series, which does seem to be that no matter how much you might want to think you used to have it good, you probably didn't have it that good.
It's interesting, the comics he's actually shown reading at the end aren't Archie books, they're crime comics in the 50s.
Yeah, and as he says, I can't believe that, you know, our parents let us get away with reading this stuff.
And these are books that have sort of been airbrushed out of the nostalgia version of comics as well.
I wonder if there is an angle going to get him. The comics he will have been reading will have been, given that this is set in 1982, we're looking at pre-code comics.
Yes. He's so clearly supposed to be born... He must be around mid-30s, late mid to late-30s.
Yeah, I'm guessing that there will be some kind of examination of the parallels between comic books that he read as kids, as a kid, and the supposed effects on children that these things were believed to have by certain slightly crazy therapists.
Burton, yeah.
Yeah,
one thing I like about this is that obviously criminal as a series is a genre piece, but genres can very easily box you in and become over familiar, and it becomes an exercise in going through the tropes. And it's nice to see him doing something which is, you know, yes, loosely within the remit of criminal, but also willing to go, you know, far beyond that and do a story which is clearly ranging a lot wider than that. I think it's nice to see that criminal has that sort of range in it.
Yes, it kind of shows that not all noir books have to be something in black and white starring a guy in a trench coat and a fedora smoking in an alleyway.
And in many ways, those plot elements are a lot more effective when they're not bound up with a whole load of over-familiar style elements that make you think, oh yes, this is a pastiche.
Yeah,
this is a pastiche in many ways, but not of noir.
No, it's, I guess it's pastiching Archie in a way, but only as a means to getting across a point, which I think is to do with the way that people idealise their youth. And when you actually take a kind of objective look back at it, it's really as it's remembered by the people who are remembering it.
It's not so much that it that the characters have changed as that they have a clearer and less rose-tinted view of how everyone is. It's a good first issue. I mean, it's a setup issue. Mm. It really is just a setup issue that finally gets the plot underway towards the end of the book.
Yeah, I think when the character work is as strong as this, though, and when the art is as good as this,
yes,
it doesn't need to have all the plot in there. I honestly could probably read an entire slice of life graphic novel of this kind of type.
No, I agree.
Baker and Phillips.
It's got so much in there that does work that it doesn't really need a strong plot in the first issue. And it does enough to say, well, that's coming in issue two anyway.
Yeah. So, Criminal Last of the Innocents there, and moving on. Do you want to do Secret 7 next?
Let's do Secret 7. This is a Flashpoint tie-in, issue 1 of 3, written by Peter Milligan, art by George Perez. Mm-hmm. Who are the Secret 7? We don't know, because they're not really in this issue.
Yeah, who are the Secret 7 people working on the art in this book?
Yes, there's a lot of art. Pencils by George Perez, pages 1 to 15. Layouts by Fernando Blanco, pages 16 to 20. Inks and finishes by Scott Koblish. Perez disappears from the credits but in the solicitations by issue 3.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's annoying. I was buying this partly on the basis of the fact that it was going to be George Perez drawing the blooming thing.
Yeah. This is billed as a Secret 7 comic, and there is mention of Shade having a team called the Secret 7, but what this actually is Peter Milligan writing Shade the Changing Man within the DC Universe.
Yeah, and there do seem to have been at least one previous Secret 7 who are all dead. And there's no real indication from the way that Shade talks through this issue as to whether, when he talks about going and gathering the rest of the Secret 7, he's actually talking about living people anymore.
Yes.
Given that when we see him in Flashpoint issue 1, it's pretty much him and I think one or two other people and a whole bunch of voices in his head.
Yes. When you see the logo on the front cover, the Secret 7 logo, that's a modification of the old Shade the Changing Man logo.
Yeah.
This is a Shade solo comic, whatever it may be called.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting in that it's Peter Milligan attempting to... who, of course, wrote the Shade the Changing Man Vertigo series, which ran for something like 75 issues, of
and
which...
50 of them were good.
50 of which were very good. And to be fair, the other 25 aren't bad either. They're just not...
They're not
on the same
standard.
This is him trying to write the original Shade, the version from Steve Ditko.
Yeah.
Although there is a vague mention halfway through that one of the effects of the madness vest in this in Flashpoint is that he exists in more than one reality at once, which makes me wonder whether at some point this is going to dovetail with the other stuff he's been doing with Shade, either the traditional Vertigo version, or for that matter, the version he's shown up in Hellblazer.
Yeah.
In which Shade is stark raving mad.
Yeah, so what the plot of this essentially is that Shade is called home by his people who try to remove his madness vest because it is in some way malfunctioning, but they realise that they can't remove it because it is now part of him. And at the same time, back on Earth, in the Flashpoint world, the Enchantress is trying to track him down so that he can help her to bring back Jun Moon, who is the sort of human side of the Enchantress.
Which I had to look up, I admit. I mean, in fairness...
I remember the Jun Moon thing from Suicide Squad.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, the story does explain the origin of the character. It is there. It's just that to know that this is an established DC Universe thing, you kind of have to go and look it up. But that's unavoidable. That's built into the premise of something like Flashpoint.
Yeah, and she is... I mean, she's not a Z-list DC character, no. The Enchantress. I mean, she did have that starring role in Suicide Squad.
She was in Shadow Pact as well, I think.
Oh, I never read any of that. To see. But yeah, so that's pretty much what happens in this book. It's kind of two halves. There's the first half is the Shade on his homeworld stuff, and the second half is the Shade talking to the Enchantress stuff. But there's not what one would call much impetus to go on to the next issue. You know, what's in the next issue is some more stuff with Shade and June, presumably.
Yeah, I'm just looking at who were the other people who were supposed to be in the original Secret Seven.
He names them.
Black Orchid, Trigon, Clarion, the Witch Boy, Simon Magus, Stiletto, and Miss X.
I know some of these characters. I'm not a huge DC fanboy or anything like that, but like, I know Black Orchid, Trigon, and Clarion, and the Enchantress and Shade, but I don't know Simon Magus, Stiletto, and Miss X, I've got to say.
I think Perez is a really interesting choice of artist for this because he's normally such a precise and realistic artist. And he's being asked here to draw Shade the Changing Man in the original Ditko style, which is all, you know, crazy fluctuating shapes and stuff which is way outside Perez's normal style.
It's the kind
and it really
of book,
does bring something out of him that you don't normally see from
Yeah,
Perez.
It's the kind of book that you would have expected them to get somebody like, I don't know, Chris Bacallo or someone like that. If they were going to bring Peter Milligan back onto it, they might get Bacallo back on, given that his style now is actually much more like the kind of the crazy 60s stuff.
I mean, there's a bit here which is bordering on Brendan McCarthy.
Oh, where he rips his chest open and his eyes come out of his head like a wolf in a Tex Avery cartoon.
It's very odd seeing George Perez drawing something like that. I mean, I think it works, but it works in large part because he's drawing something which is so far out of his established style.
It is playing him against type, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, one advantage of Perez having such a strongly defined regular style is that when he has a scene where he really needs to go beyond that, it makes it, it's so much more effective.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And Milligan, I mean, there's one character that Milligan knows how to write, it's Shade. Milligan could probably do this in his sleep now.
Yeah.
And so, with that in mind, I'm not that disappointed that this isn't a book about seven characters. If it's just a book about Shade, written by Peter Milligan and drawn largely by George Perez, I'm actually quite happy with that.
I'm quite happy with it as well, but I have to admit, I'm not sure that this really works as a story as opposed to something that depends on a set of allusions to regular DC continuity and even vague allusions to the Milligan's out-of-continuity Shade series.
Mm-hmm.
I think, to be fair, it's probably a safe assumption that most readers will have that information.
Well, interesting you say that because my wife read this book, Gary read this book, and she was able to follow it quite easily, but she just took it all at face value. Which, if you do that and you're not looking for allusions and you're not looking for references back to the old DC stuff,
it works perfectly.
It does
well,
work
it?
Fine. The one thing that she did get annoyed with was, as she said, stupid dog comic, which is this enormous Super 8 pullout in the middle.
Yeah, DC, no.
Just stop it. This is in every blooming book this week.
This publication is not... It's going to be in every book this month.
Ugh.
This publication is not intended for sale. I don't think you could give it away.
Yeah, no. Poo. The thing is, Tomasi and Tommy Lee Edwards are the people who are responsible for this.
Sad. Oh, well. This is a comic. I liked it. I think I liked it in large part because I get the some of the broader references to Milligan's other work with Shade. I'm not sure I'd have got that much out of it if I was just taking it purely at face value.
I liked it as just an issue with Shade going about doing stuff.
Yeah.
Milligan writing Shade as a character is always interesting and entertaining. And Perez's art is just great, and I'm sure will always be great. The parts of it that he actually draws in this issue. As a tie-in to Flashpoint,
heaven only
I
knows.
Can see absolutely no link.
Oh, there is. There's a reference to Cyborg trying to assemble a group.
Yeah, that's about it, though. I mean, they might as well just at the beginning have him stand up and say, Flashpoint, then just got on with the rest of the story.
Well, to be fair, the other point is they do say, in terms, Shade is existing in two realities simultaneously. That is a potential important plot point later on.
If what they're talking about is regular DCU and Flashpoint, if not, if they are talking about, you know, Shade the Changing Man by Vertigo.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's
Flashpoint.
It can't be completely insignificant that when we first see Shade, he's wearing that multicolored coat thing. That's not part of the original Shade design. That's
no,
from the Vertigo
series. Stuff.
And the first character he meets is Black Orchid, who is also Vertigo.
Yes.
There's.
So in that case, then, that makes it more likely that it's tying into the Vertigo stuff and not into Flashpoint.
Well, I mean, that's also, to be fair, that's also periods in the dawn of Vertigo. The early Shade the Changing Man series is supposed to be in continuity.
And also,
it's just sort of diverged at some point.
Flashpoint issue 2 establishes that Flashpoint is not an alternate reality. It is the real DCU, but it has been changed. So the real DCU is not out there, whilst Flashpoint is around.
Can I say I really liked the cliffhanger at the end of Flashpoint 2?
I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was so... I laughed and I laughed. Like, I wish every
issue...
In a
good way.
I wish every issue of Barry Allen's Flash ended like that.
Why don't we have more comics that are willing to do things like that? I discovered reading the Captain America Index this week that in 1943, Marvel published a story entitled Captain America versus Ali Baba and his 40 Nazis. That must have been fantastic.
Oh my goodness, that sounds amazing!
Yes!
Alibaba is 40 Nazis!
I think an entire series... I would love to see an anthology title where people, where modern-day creators, attempt to do stories based solely on the titles of Golden Age Captain America stories.
I'm going to form a ska band called Alibaba and the 40 Nazis. Anyway, so that's Secret 7. Moving on to our final comic, which is 50 Girls 50 from Image.
Yes. This is written by Doug Murray and Frank Cho, with art by Axel Madelin, created by Frank Cho and Doug Murray. What we have here is...
It's a bit like, you know that episode of Extras with Patrick Stewart?
It is exactly like that. Frank Cho... You know what you're getting with Frank Cho. He's a cheesecake artist.
Yeah.
He did do Liberty Meadows, didn't he?
Yeah.
Which was a well-received book.
Yeah, I mean, he's good at what he does.
Yeah.
That's not to everybody's taste, but he does it well.
Yeah, and what this is basically a cheesecake book which Frank Cho didn't have time to actually draw. So they had an online competition... quite some time ago, I think starting tail end of 2009, in which they invited people to compete to be the artist, and the winner is a guy called Axel Madelin. I assume that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, this is his first professional work.
Yeah.
So just to be clear, what we have here is a Frank Cho cheesecake comic, which he doesn't draw, but which they've got in a rookie artist to draw instead.
Because when you're looking at a Frank Cho cheesecake comic,
you've come for the writing. There is a premise.
The premise is some girls go to space and they go to a planet that makes their clothes fall off.
You think we're joking?
We're not even.
We're not even. This is a 4-issue miniseries. The premise, in theory, is that... Oh, I see that all work is copyright Frank Cho and Doug Murray. Well done, Axel Madelin,
that's
there.
A shame, thanks,
the premise of this series is supposed to be that Earth in the future is dying, needs resources, blah, blah, blah. The only way they can get them is by going to other planets. So far,
okay.
So good. The only way they can get to other planets is using wormholes.
Oh, yeah, sure, okay.
And it turns out that the only people who can get through wormholes without dying are hot babes.
It's not specifically it's hot babes, but anything with a Y chromosome will die when it goes through.
Well, that's a bit vague about this, actually.
Does it not say on the news report thing there? It says, Y chromosomes were incompatible with wormhole travel, although it does then go on to say, an all-female crew was assembled consisting of some of the greatest scientific and military minds our world has to offer, regardless of gender.
As long as they're women.
Regardless of gender, but completely regarding of gender.
Yeah, I think, to be fair, what they meant was that the people on the crew are among the greatest scientific minds regardless of gender. But yeah, it's badly written, that bit.
You could basically rephrase that into, these people are the smartest people on the planet, even though they're girls!
But to be fair, the basic setup they're going for here is, okay, you've got to assemble an all-female crew. There's actually a contradiction between the story itself and the essay at the back by Doug Murray, because the story just says you need to assemble a crew of women, and these are the best women on the planet. The bit at the back says that actually it's only women with three X chromosomes who can go through the through the portal, and that there's a very good reason to be explained in future arcs, if they get that far, as to why it is that all the women on the planet with three X chromosomes are roughly the same age and are hot babes. You think, really, Doug? You're going to explain that? You're going to explain that? Because don't. In an odd way... That completely contradicts the story itself, in which it's just said to be any woman can go through the portal, but there's only 50 of them can be on the ship at any given time. They talk about the possibility of being replaced on the next mission. In a strange way, I'd actually prefer to read the version that's described at the back, because that's the sort of thing that I think somebody like... what's his name who does Empowered?
Adam Warren.
Adam Warren could get a good series out of the idea of... Earth is in terrible danger and can only be saved by by 50 hot women who have been selected not on the strength of having any talent whatsoever, but just because they get through the wormhole. I think that is the sort of thing that could actually make a vaguely decent Adam Warren comic. What we've got here, though, is a bunch of women have been sent through this portal, and oh, it turns out they're having trouble getting back, so it's Voyager, and then they find a planet and they go down to explore it and all their clothes fall off.
So it's the Patrick Stewart episode of Extras.
Literally, it is a planet which makes all your clothes fall off. That's the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just literally like they stand there and then they just go boing out of their clothes. It's that this planet has got trace elements. It doesn't say trace elements of what. They just say, oh, it's those trace elements. And they dissolve plastic, and all their clothes are made out entirely of plastic, which must be uncomfortable. So, yeah, your main character in it is a woman called Oksana Bakula, which I'm sure was a song from The Lion King. And she goes down to the planet with one of the other women, and they end up basically dressed like Shanna the She-Devil and fighting a load of monsters to get back up off the surface of the planet.
Yeah. That's basically it. I mean, there is some sort of overreaching plot, but you know, fundamentally, it's a story in which two women go down to an alien planet and their clothes fall off. And yeah, you can't really develop the point much beyond that. Here's the thing. If you're going to do this and it's going to work, then you've either got to have spectacular art to the point where nobody cares that the story is rubbish, or... you've got to play it for laughs in a way that is actually funny. This is not written in a way that's actually funny. It's written in a way that suggests that they're actually trying to take the plot relatively seriously, even though it's contrived in such a way as to guarantee that all their clothes fall off.
Yeah, people are going to be laughing at the plot of this comic regardless. And part of that is because it's got absolutely no sort of sense of self-awareness or sense of humour to it. All it's concerned with is engineering a situation in which two babes go to a planet and all their clothes fall off. Ironically, what it seems is that when you look at the art in this, Axel Madelon's art is actually pretty great. I can see why he won the competition. He's actually, I would say, a good artist.
There's nothing wrong with the art in this. In many ways, the artist actually seems more interested in the plot than the writers
this
do.
This is the thing. He's the one that's interested in telling the story and getting the story across. The writers are more interested in showing the cheesecake. it may have worked out better for everyone if they'd just swapped.
Yes, really, Cho should have just drawn the thing himself if that was what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
I mean, he's doing his best with it, but I mean, he's actually not. It seems to me he's genuinely more interested in wanting to do the story.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Empowered does get away with doing this sort of thing because it's so obviously tongue-in-cheek and so obviously knowing and self-aware.
This is just kind of skeevy.
It is. It's sort of... You kind of imagine the plot discussions between Frank Cho and Doug Murray and just going, so the idea, right, is like this portal and it's only... It's only like hot babes that can go through it.
What if we like if all the babes right weren't a planet, and all their clothes fall off?
You're a visionary. You're a visionary.
Thanks, Frank.
That's a creative process.
Tales of Cockney Frank Show there.
Is that what we were doing?
I believe so. Yeah, this is an unfortunate comic in that. I kind of wish Axel Dillon had won a competition to draw a different comic.
So do I, because I think the art's fine. I've got no problem with the art.
Yeah, the story's pretty awful.
Yeah.
So, 50 Girls 50 then. That was pretty bad. That is the comics for this episode. We're going to go on now to the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. And we've picked up, actually, a fair few listeners since last time around, so we should just probably run through the concept of this again. We go through the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. We find a character who's been languishing in the depths of the Marvel U for a long time without being used, and we give him a bit of a kick in the pants and a bit of a reinvention.
And this time
round, we're looking at a Quasar character, and a real. We're talking about, you know, hot things from space. This one's a real looker. This is the strange spiky worm tentacle thing called Anomaly.
It looks a bit like a sea monkey.
A sea monkey crossed with a seahorse crossed with a cactus.
It's an interesting design there from Greg Capullo.
Yeah.
I think he designed it.
I think he probably designed it in his sleep.
Or I like it.
Some sort of... It looks like he's been designed with fitting a pen onto a Ouija board and just kind of seeing where the lines take you. This weird thing is that it was, according to the handbook, it was perhaps older than the current universe. And it had allegedly perceived an unfulfilled conceptual niche in Earth's dimension.
He's a modern artist.
It travelled there and altered itself to fill that niche as an abstract entity embodying those concepts. And its thing was that it was embodying all things that are unlike all other things. It was completely unique, just like everything else is. Yeah. It's a bit of a strange one to get your head around. The Anomaly, it didn't have a sort of set of powers. It was immune to, you know, most attacks and could disrupt most energy. And
it's general body, cosmic stuff.
Yeah, its body is not actually its body. It's just kind of a construct that it's put together, which it called an M-body.
That's part of a storyline from Quasar at the time, as I recall. It's a general explanation of why concepts have bodies in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. But what its thing is that it kind of hangs around in our universe, deliberately embodying an unfulfilled conceptual niche of being, you know, like all things that are unlike all other things. He's a weirdo.
I quite like the idea that he's the embodiment of an undefined concept.
Mm-hmm. He's filling an unfulfilled conceptual niche. What I could see happening with this guy is like he appears in front of that entire council of anthropomorphized concepts where, you know, you've got Galactus is there and the Stranger and the In-Betweener and...
Love, hate, order
chaos. And all these kinds of guys. And what he's saying is, I have identified an unfulfilled conceptual niche. And the others all have to decide whether they want to invest in that particular unfulfilled niche that he has spotted in the market.
Ooh, I like that. Dragon's Den, but for...
A conceptual Dragon's Den for cosmic beings.
So somebody would come in and pitch the idea of a new concept, not yet covered, even by the In-Between of Galactus.
Exactly. The Anomaly is like, now, what we need is, I could be ennui. How does that sound to you, huh? You give me one of those cheers.
Not so much a concept, more of an emotion. Next.
Living Tribunal gives a big thumbs down. And it comes back in again and is like, well, how's about I could be something like disgust at seeing somebody not pick up dog poo. What about that? What about that? That's pretty, you know, people feel that quite strongly. That could work.
Have we ever done numinous?
Yes,
I think we have.
It looks like Whoopi Goldberg.
Yes, the character who embodies the spirit of wonder in the universe and looks like a cross between Whoopi Goldberg and a Muppet, as drawn by Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
Anomaly is an interesting one, just because it's a concept of not being a defined concept. I kind of like that.
Yeah, it's a concept of being unlike all other concepts.
Every so often, Mark Grunwald, who was writing Quasar, would come along with something that was pure Grant Morrison.
There's this odd
sort of middle ground between those two.
It's really, I think Grunwald must just have kept a jotter by his bed, so he'd wake up in the middle of the night and write something down. Then he wakes up in the morning and he looks at it and he says, "What? Start a dog walking company? What?" And then below it's like, "Character who embodies all things that are unlike all other things. What?" Yeah, the other way I could see this guy going as well, of course, is that he could, if he embodies all things that are unlike all other things, he's so not into the same stuff that everyone else is into. He is like the universal embodiment of hipsterishness.
But then he has to move on as soon as he's followed.
Well, I'm sure he would be. I'm sure that's what he would have to do anyway. Like, as soon as something else becomes like one of the things that he embodies, he can't embody that thing anymore. He is properly the embodiment of "I liked it before it was big."
I like the fact that this guy demonstrates that within the Marvel Universe, it's possible to simply declare yourself to be a conceptual embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably at some point, if one of these things gets destroyed, they could have job interviews.
Yeah, for
people from around the world auditioning
be...
to be the new in-betweener.
That would be cool. That's actually not a bad idea for a story. Like, if one of these things gets destroyed, then presumably the niche still, you know, the unfulfilled conceptual niche will need to be fulfilled.
Yeah, death, eternity, infinity.
So if he is the one who is perceiving these unfulfilled conceptual niches, then maybe instead of applying to fill them himself, he should be the one who is getting people to fill them. He is good at identifying unfulfilled conceptual niches. He is the Cosmic Pantheon's recruitment officer. He's the one who sits down with people, gives them a little plate of bourbon biscuits, and does a 45-minute interview with them, maybe some kind of logic conceptual puzzles things to see how good they are with lateral thinking.
Have you had any experience as a concept, perhaps as a holiday job?
I can imagine that. That would be absolutely fantastic. You know, Galactus just goes to the Anomaly and says, "Anomaly, look, seriously, we're all having to do double shifts now because we don't have Oblivion anymore. Remember the last Oblivion quit, like, a month ago? And we're all absolutely run ragged. I've got a lot of planets to eat, you know, 9 to 5. I can't be staying on here till 7 or 8 o'clock at night doing Oblivion stuff. You need to get on this and get someone." And
Anomaly's just still trapped as a squirrel, isn't it?
Yeah, and Anomaly's just like, "Look, all I can do is, you know, act on the CVs that come in. People aren't applying to be Oblivion. It's just not that bad a job market yet."
Maybe what they ought to have is an entire structure, because, you know, it obviously one single concept can't easily maintain control of the entire universe. They ought to have localized concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be a local version of order or death or whatever for each part of the world, possibly down to a town council level.
Yes.
And then you'd rise through the ranks over time to eventually become the actual death.
So you start at a particular level, and Anomaly is placing people in these positions because they've gone, "Right, what we need is we've got a vacancy for somebody to be the Lord Order of Lowestoft," and then eventually you go up to, like, operating at a county level, and then eventually you become, like, the English version of Lord Order, and then maybe you become a European version. Eventually it's just a kind of intergalactic thing.
So what sort of things is Anomaly actually responsible for on a day-to-day basis? Is it like sort of continuity errors, or is he responsible for things such as minor contradictions in the tax code and the recent career of David Hasselhoff?
Yeah, he's responsible for all those things that are not like anything else. So presumably the things that you can't explain with normal science and physics, like Jedward.
None of the above.
The Anomaly Party, vote none of the above. Anyway, that's the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. and it's the end of our podcast. And we will be back in about 2 weeks' time.
About 2 weeks' time?
Yeah, I need to talk to you about this. I probably won't be able to do this 2 Saturdays from now. But okay. Anyway, we'll be around a fortnight from now, we'll be back. But until then, you can follow us at the blog, which is housetoastonish.com.
You can follow us on Twitter, where I'm Iv Destroyed and Al is House to Astonish.
Yeah, you can email us, housetoastonish@gmail.com. And we've got our Facebook fan page as well. You just go to Facebook and search for House to Astonish. And as always, all iTunes reviews, very gratefully received. So we'll see you in about 2 weeks' time.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.